This is Randy Wasserstrom with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome you to our readings from Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl. With me today is Susie Pratt, who will be reading the actual diary entries written by Anne. This show is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Feel free to call us with any comments or questions about this show or any other subject pertaining to Triangle Radio Reading Service. We're here to serve our listeners, and your input will help us to do a better job. The number is 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. You can also visit our website at www.trianglereadingservice.org. Thanks again for joining us.
Friday, July 10th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, I've probably bored you with my long description of our house, but I still think you should know where I've ended up. How I ended up here is something you'll figure out from my next letters. But first, let me continue my story, because as you know, I wasn't finished. After we arrived at 263 Prinzengracht, Miep quickly led us through the long hallway and up the wooden staircase to the next floor and into the annex. She shut the door behind us, leaving us alone. Margot had arrived much earlier on our bike and was waiting for us. Our living room and all the other rooms were so full of stuff that I can't find the words to describe it. All the cardboard boxes that had been sent to the office in the last few months were piled on the floors and beds. The small room was filled from floor to ceiling with linens. If we wanted to sleep in properly made beds that night, we had to get going and straighten up the mess. Mother and Margot were unable to move a muscle. They lay down on their bare mattresses, tired, miserable, and I don't know what else. But Father and I, the two cleaner-uppers in the family, started in right away. All day long, we unpacked boxes, filled cupboards, hammered nails, and straightened up the mess until we fell exhausted into our clean beds at night. We hadn't eaten a hot meal all day, but we didn't care. Mother and Margot were too tired and keyed up to eat, and Father and I were too busy. Tuesday morning, we started where we left off the night before. Bep and Miep went grocery shopping with our ration coupons. Father worked on our blackout screens. We scrubbed the kitchen floor and were once again busy from sunup to sundown. Until Wednesday, I didn't have the chance to think about the enormous change in my life. Then, for the first time since our arrival in the secret annex, I found a moment to tell you all about it, and to realize what had happened to me and what was yet to happen. Yours, Anne. Saturday, July 11th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, Father, Mother, and Margot still can't get used to the chiming of Wester Torren clock, which tells us the time every quarter of an hour. Not me. I liked it from the start. It sounds so reassuring, especially at night. You no doubt want to hear what I think of being in hiding. Well, all I can say is that I don't really know yet. I don't think I'll ever feel at home in this house, but that doesn't mean I hate it. It's more like being on vacation in some strange pension. Kind of an odd way to look at life in hiding, but that's how things are. The annex is an ideal place to hide in. It may be damp and lopsided, but there's probably not a more comfortable hiding place in all of Amsterdam. No, in all of Holland. Up to now, our bedroom with its blank walls was very bare. Thanks to Father, who brought my entire postcard and movie star collection here beforehand, and a brush and a pot of glue, I was able to plaster the walls with pictures. It looks much more cheerful. When the Van Dans arrive, we'll be able to build cupboards and other odds and ends out of the wood piled in the attic. Margot and Mother have recovered somewhat. Yesterday, Mother felt well enough to cook split pea soup for the first time. But then she was downstairs talking and forgot all about it. The beans were scorched black, and no amount of scraping could get them out of the pan. Last night, the four of us went down to the private office and listened to England on the radio. I was so scared someone might hear it that I literally begged Father to take me back upstairs. Mother understood my anxiety and went with me. Whatever we do, we're very afraid the neighbors might hear or see us. We started off immediately the first day sewing curtains. Actually, you can hardly call them that, since they're nothing but scraps of fabric varying greatly in shape, quality, and pattern, which Father and I stitched crookedly together with unskilled fingers. These works of art were tacked to the windows, where they'll stay until we come out of hiding. The building on our right is a branch of the Keg Company, a firm from Zaandam, and on the left is a furniture workshop. Though the people who work there are not on the premises after hours, any sound we make might travel through the walls. We've forbidden Margot to cough at night, even though she has a bad cold, and we are giving her large doses of codeine. I'm looking forward to the arrival of the Van Dans, which is set for Tuesday. It will be much more fun and also not as quiet. You see, it's the silence that makes me so nervous during the evenings and nights, and I'd give anything to have one of our helpers sleep here. It's really not that bad here, since we can do our own cooking and can listen to the radio in Daddy's office. Mr. Kleiman and me and Bep Baskill, too, have helped so much. We've already canned loads of rhubarb, strawberries, and cherries, so for the time being I doubt we'll be bored. We also have a supply of reading material, and we're going to buy lots of games. Of course, we can't ever look out the window or go outside. And we have to be quiet, so the people downstairs can't hear us. Yesterday, we had our hands full. We had to pit 2 crates of cherries for Mr. Kugler to can. We're going to use the empty crates to make bookshelves. Someone's calling me. Yours, Anne. Comment added by Anne on September 2, 1942. Not being able to go outside upsets me more than I can say, and I'm terrified our hiding place will be discovered and that we'll be shot. That, of course, is a fairly dismal prospect. Sunday, July 12, 1942. They've all been so nice to me this last month because of my birthday, and yet every day I feel myself drifting further away from Mother and Margot. I worked hard today, and they praised me, only to start picking on me again 5 minutes later. You can easily see the difference between the way they deal with Margot and the way they deal with me. For example, Margot broke the vacuum cleaner, and because of that, we've been without light for the rest of the day. Mother said, "Well, Margot, it's easy to see you're not used to working, otherwise you'd have known better than to yank the plug out by the cord." Margot made some reply, and that was the end of the story. But this afternoon, when I wanted to rewrite something on Mother's shopping list because her handwriting is so hard to read, she wouldn't let me. She bawled me out again, and the whole family wound up getting involved. I don't fit in with them, and I've felt that clearly in the last few weeks. They're so sentimental together, but I'd rather be sentimental on my own. They're always saying how nice it is with the four of us, and that we get along so well, without giving a moment's thought to the fact that I don't feel that way. Daddy's the only one who understands me, now and again, though he usually sides with Mother and Margot. Another thing I can't stand is having them talk about me in front of outsiders, telling them how I cried or how sensibly I'm behaving. It's horrible. And sometimes they talk about Morcha, and I can't take that at all. Morcha is my weak spot. I miss her every minute of the day, and no one knows how often I think of her. Whenever I do, my eyes fill with tears. Morcha is so sweet, and I love her so much that I keep dreaming she'll come back to us. I have plenty of dreams, but the reality is that we'll have to stay here until the war is over. We can't ever go outside, and the only visitors we can have are Miep, her husband Jan, Bep Vaskul, Mr. Kugler, Mr. Kleiman, and Mrs. Kleiman, though she hasn't come because she thinks it's too dangerous. Comment added by Anne in September 1942. Daddy's always so nice. He understands me perfectly, and I wish we could have a heart-to-heart talk sometime without my bursting instantly into tears. But apparently that has to do with my age. I'd like to spend all my time writing, but that would probably get boring. Up to now, I've only confided my thoughts to my diary. I still haven't gotten around to writing amusing sketches that I could read aloud at a later date. In the future, I'm going to devote less time to sentimentality and more time to reality. Friday, August 14th, 1942. Dear Kitty, I've deserted you for an entire month, but so little has happened that I can't find a newsworthy item to relate every single day. The Van Dans arrived on July 13th. We thought they were coming on the 14th. But from the 13th to the 16th, the Germans were sending out call-up notices right and left, causing a lot of unrest. So they decided it would be safer to leave a day too early than a day too late. Peter Van Dan arrived at 9:30 in the morning, while we were still at breakfast. Peter's going on 16, a shy, awkward boy whose company won't amount to much. Mr. and Mrs. Van Dan came half an hour later. Much to our amusement, Mrs. Van Dan was carrying a hat box with a large chamber pot inside. "I just don't feel at home without my chamber pot," she exclaimed, and it was the first item to find a permanent place under the divan. Instead of a chamber pot, Mr. Van D was lugging a collapsible tea table under his arm. From the first, we ate our meals together, and after 3 days, it felt as if the seven of us had become one big family. Naturally, the Van Dans had much to tell about the week we'd been away from civilization. We were especially interested in what had happened to our apartment and to Mr. Goldschmidt. Mr. Van Dan filled us in. Monday morning at 9, Mr. Goldschmidt phoned and asked if I could come over. I went straight away and found a very distraught Mr. Goldschmidt. He showed me a note that the Frank family had left behind. As instructed, he was planning to bring the cat to the neighbors, which I agreed was a good idea. He was afraid the house was going to be searched, so we went through all the rooms, straightening up here and there and clearing the breakfast things off the table. Suddenly, I saw a notepad on Mrs. Frank's desk with an address in Maastricht written on it. Even though I knew Mrs. Frank had left it on purpose, I pretended to be surprised and horrified and begged Mr. Goldschmidt to burn this incriminating piece of paper. I swore up and down that I knew nothing about the disappearance, but that the note had given me an idea. "Mr. Goldschmidt," I said, "I bet I know what this address refers to. About 6 months ago, a high-ranking officer came to the office. It seems he and Mr. Frank grew up together. He promised to help Mr. Frank if it was ever necessary. As I recall, he was stationed in Maastricht. I think this officer has kept his word and is somehow planning to help them cross over to Belgium and then to Switzerland. There's no harm in telling this to any friends of the Franks who come asking about them. Of course, you don't need to mention the part about Maastricht." And after that, I left. This is the story most of your friends have been told, because I heard it later from several other people. Well, we thought this was extremely funny, but we laughed even harder when Mr. Van Dan told us that certain people have vivid imaginations. For example, one family living on our square claimed that they saw all four of us riding by on our bikes early in the morning, and another woman was absolutely positive we'd been loaded into some kind of military vehicle in the middle of the night. Yours, Anne. Friday, August 21st, 1942. Dear Kitty, now our secret annex has truly become secret. Because so many houses are being searched for hidden bicycles, Mr. Kugler thought it would be better to have a bookcase built in front of the entrance to our hiding place. It swings out on its hinges and opens like a door. Mr. Voskuhl did the carpentry work. Mr. Voskuhl has been told that the seven of us are in hiding, and he's been most helpful. Now, whenever we want to go downstairs, we have to duck and then jump. After the first 3 days, we were all walking around with bumps on our foreheads from banging our heads against the low doorway. Then Peter cushioned it by nailing a towel stuffed with wood shavings to the doorframe. Let's see if it helps. I'm not doing much schoolwork. I've given myself a vacation until September. Father wants to start tutoring me then. But we have to buy all the books first. There's little change in our lives here. Peter's hair was washed today, but that's nothing special. Mr. Van Dan and I are always at loggerheads with each other. Mama always treats me like a baby, which I can't stand. For the rest, things are going better. I don't think Peter's gotten any nicer. He's an obnoxious boy who lies around on his bed all day, only rousing himself to do a little carpentry work before returning to his nap. What a dope. Mama gave me another one of her dreadful sermons this morning. We take the opposite view of everything. Daddy's a sweetheart. He may get mad at me, but it never lasts longer than 5 minutes. It's a beautiful day outside, nice and hot, and in spite of everything, we make the most of the weather by lounging on the folding bed in the attic. Yours, Anne. Comment added by Anne on September 21, 1942. Mr. Van Dan has been as nice as pie to me recently. I've said nothing, but I've been enjoying it while it lasts. Wednesday, September 2, 1942. Dearest Kitty, Mr. and Mrs. Van Dan have had a terrible fight. I've never seen anything like it since Mother and Father wouldn't dream of shouting at each other like that. The argument was based on something so trivial it didn't seem worth wasting a single word on it. Oh well, to each his own. Of course, it's very difficult for Peter, who gets caught in the middle, but no one takes Peter seriously anymore, since he's hypersensitive and lazy. Yesterday he was beside himself with worry because his tongue was blue instead of pink. This rare phenomenon disappeared as quickly as it came. Today he's walking around with a heavy scarf on because he's got a stiff neck. His Highness has been complaining of lumbago, too. Aches and pains in his heart, kidneys, and lungs are also par for the course. He's an absolute hypochondriac. That's the right word, isn't it? Mother and Mrs. Van Dan aren't getting along very well. There are enough reasons for the friction. To give you one small example, Mrs. Van D has removed all but three of her sheets from our communal linen closet. She's assuming that Mother's can be used for both families. She'll be in for a nasty surprise when she discovers that Mother has followed her lead. Furthermore, Mrs. Van D is ticked off because we're using her china instead of ours. She's still trying to find out what we've done with our plates. They're a lot closer than she thinks, since they're packed in a cardboard box in the attic, behind a load of Opecta advertising material. As long as we're in hiding, the plates will remain out of her reach. Since I'm always having accidents, it's just as well. Yesterday, I broke one of Mrs. Van D's soup bowls. Oh! She angrily exclaimed. Can't you be more careful? That was my last one! Please bear in mind, Kitty, that the two ladies speak abominable Dutch. I don't dare comment on the gentlemen. They'd be highly insulted. If you were to hear their bungled attempts, you'd laugh your head off. We've given up pointing out their errors, since correcting them doesn't help anyway. Whenever I quote Mother or Mrs. Van Dan, I'll write proper Dutch instead of trying to duplicate their speech. Last week there was a brief interruption in our monotonous routine. This was provided by Peter in a book about women. I should explain that Margot and Peter are allowed to read nearly all the books Mr. Kleiman lends us, but the adults preferred to keep this special book to themselves. This immediately piqued Peter's curiosity. What forbidden fruit did it contain? He snuck off with it when his mother was downstairs talking and took himself and his booty to the loft. For 2 days all was well. Mrs. Van Dan knew what he was up to, but kept mum until Mr. Van Dan found out about it. He threw a fit, took the book away, and assumed that would be the end of the business. However, he'd neglected to take his son's curiosity into account. Peter, not in the least fazed by his father's swift action, began thinking up ways to read the rest of this vastly interesting book. In the meantime, Mrs. Van D. asked Mother for her opinion. Mother didn't think this particular book was suitable for Margot, but she saw no harm in letting her read most other books. You see, Mrs. Van Dan, Mother said, there's a big difference between Margot and Peter. To begin with, Margot's a girl, and girls are always more mature than boys. Second, she's already read many serious books and doesn't go looking for those which are no longer forbidden. Third, Margot is much more sensible and intellectually advanced as a result of her 4 years at an excellent school. Mrs. Van Dan agreed with her, but felt it was wrong as a matter of principle to let youngsters read books written for adults. Meanwhile, Peter had thought of a suitable time when no one would be interested in either him or the book. At 7:30 in the evening, when the entire family was listening to the radio in the private office, he took his treasure and stole off to the loft again. He should have been back by 8:30, but he was so engrossed in the book that he forgot the time and was just coming down the stairs when his father entered the room. The scene that followed was not surprising. After a slap, a whack, and a tug of war, the book lay on the table and Peter was in the loft. This is how matters stood when it was time for the family to eat. Peter stayed upstairs. No one gave him a moment's thought. He'd have to go to bed without his dinner. We continued eating, chatting merrily away, when suddenly we heard a piercing whistle. We lay down our forks and stared at each other, the shock clearly visible on our pale faces. Then we heard Peter's voice through the chimney. "I won't come down!" Mr. Van Dan leapt up, his napkin falling to the floor, and shouted, with the blood rushing to his face, "I've had enough!" Father, afraid of what might happen, grabbed him by the arm, and the two men went to the attic. After much struggling and kicking, Peter wound up in his room with the door shut, and we went on eating. Mrs. Van Dan wanted to save a piece of bread for her darling son, but Mr. Van D was adamant. If he doesn't apologize this minute, he'll have to sleep in the loft. We protested that going without dinner was enough punishment. What if Peter were to catch cold? We wouldn't be able to call a doctor. Peter didn't apologize and returned to the loft. Mr. Van Dan decided to leave well enough alone, though he did note the next morning that Peter's bed had been slept in. At 7, Peter went to the attic again, but was persuaded to come downstairs when Father spoke a few friendly words to him. After 3 days of sullen looks and stubborn silence, everything was back to normal. Yours, Anne. Monday, September 21st, 1942. Dearest Kitty, today I'll tell you the general news here in the annex. A lamp has been mounted above my divan bed so that in the future, when I hear the guns going off, I'll be able to pull a cord and switch on the light. I can't use it at the moment because we're keeping our window open a little, day and night. The male members of the Van Dan contingent have built a very handy wood-stained food safe with real screens. Up to now, this glorious cupboard has been located in Peter's room, but in the interests of fresh air, it's been moved to the attic. Where it once stood, there's now a shelf. I advised Peter to put his table underneath the shelf, add a nice rug, and hang his own cupboard where the table now stands. That might make his little cubbyhole more comfy, though I certainly wouldn't like to sleep there. Mrs. Van Dan is unbearable. I'm continually being scolded for my incessant chatter when I'm upstairs. I simply let the words bounce right off me. Madame now has a new trick up her sleeve, trying to get out of washing the pots and pans. If there's a bit of food left at the bottom of the pan, she leaves it to spoil instead of transferring it to the glass dish. Then, in the afternoon when Margot is stuck with cleaning all the pots and pans, Madame exclaims, "Oh, poor Margot, you have so much work to do." Every other week, Mr. Kleiman brings me a couple of books written for girls my age. I'm enthusiastic about the Loup der Hule series. I've enjoyed all of Sissy Van Marksveld's books very much. I've read The Zaniest Summer 4 times, and the ludicrous situations still make me laugh. Father and I are currently working on our family tree, and he tells me something about each person as we go along. I've begun my schoolwork. I'm working hard at French, cramming 5 irregular verbs into my head every day. But I've forgotten much too much of what I learned in school. Peter has taken up his English with great reluctance. A few school books have just arrived, and I brought a large supply of notebooks, pencils, erasers, and labels from home. Pim, that's our pet name for Father, wants me to help him with his Dutch lessons. I'm perfectly willing to tutor him in exchange for his assistance with French and other subjects. But he makes the most unbelievable mistakes. I sometimes listen to Dutch broadcasts from London. Prince Bernhard recently announced that Princess Juliana is expecting a baby in January, which I think is wonderful. No one here understands why I take such an interest in the royal family. A few nights ago, I was the topic of discussion, and we all decided I was an ignoramus. As a result, I threw myself into my schoolwork the next day, since I have little desire to still be a freshman when I'm 14 or 15. The fact that I'm hardly allowed to read anything was also discussed. At the moment, Mother's reading Gentlemen, Wives, and Servants, and of course I'm not allowed to read it, though Margot is. First, I have to be more intellectually developed, like my genius sister. Then we discussed my ignorance of philosophy, psychology, and physiology. I immediately looked up these big words in the dictionary. It's true. I don't know anything about these subjects, but maybe I'll be smarter next year. I've come to the shocking conclusion that I have only one long-sleeved dress and 3 cardigans to wear in the winter. Father's given me permission to knit a white wool sweater. The yarn isn't very pretty, but it'll be warm, and that's what counts. Some of our clothing was left with friends, but unfortunately we won't be able to get to it until after the war, provided it's still there, of course. I just finished writing something about Mrs. Van Dan when she walked into the room. Thump! I slammed the book shut. Hey, Anne, can't I even take a peek? No, Mrs. Van Dan. Just the last page, then? No, not even the last page, Mrs. Van Dan. Of course, I nearly died, since that particular page contained a rather unflattering description of her. There's something happening every day, but I'm too tired and lazy to write it all down. Yours, Anne. Friday, September 25th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, Father has a friend, a man in his mid-70s named Mr. Dreher, who's sick, poor, and deaf as a post. At his side, like a useless appendage, is his wife, 27 years younger and equally poor, whose arms and legs are loaded with real and fake bracelets and rings left over from more prosperous days. This Mr. Dreher has already been a great nuisance to Father, and I've always admired the saintly patience with which he handled this pathetic old man on the phone. When we were still living at home, Mother used to advise him to put a gramophone in front of the receiver, one that would repeat every 3 minutes, "Yes, Mr. Dreher," and "No, Mr. Dreher," since the old man never understood a word of Father's lengthy replies anyway. Today, Mr. Dreher phoned the office and asked Mr. Kugler to come and see him. Mr. Kugler wasn't in the mood and said he would send Miep, but Miep canceled the appointment. Mrs. Dreher called the office 3 times, but since Miep was reportedly out the entire afternoon, she had to imitate Bep's voice. Downstairs in the office, as well as upstairs in the annex, there was great hilarity. Now each time the phone rings, Bep says, "That's Mrs. Dreher," and Miep has to laugh, so that the people on the other end of the line are greeted with an impolite giggle. Can't you just picture it? This has got to be the greatest office in the whole wide world. The bosses and the office girls have such fun together. Some evenings I go to the Van Dans for a little chat. We eat mothball cookies, molasses cookies that were stored in a closet that was mothproofed, and have a good time. Recently, the conversation was about Peter. I said that he often pats me on the cheek, which I don't like. They asked me in a typically grown-up way whether I could ever learn to love Peter like a brother, since he loves me like a sister. "Oh, no," I said, but what I was thinking was, "Oh, ugh, just imagine." I added that Peter's a bit stiff, perhaps because he's shy. Boys who aren't used to being around girls are like that. I must say that the Annex Committee, the men's section, is very creative. Listen to the scheme they've come up with to get a message to Mr. Brox, an OPECA sales representative and friend who's surreptitiously hidden some of our things for us. They're going to type a letter to a store owner in Southern Zealand who is indirectly one of OPECA's customers and ask him to fill out a form and send it back in the enclosed self-addressed envelope. Father will write the address on the envelope himself. Once the letter is returned from Zealand, the form can be removed and a handwritten message confirming that Father is alive can be inserted into the envelope. This way, Mr. Brox can read the letter without suspecting a ruse. They chose the province of Zealand because it's close to Belgium. A letter can easily be smuggled across the border, and because no one is allowed to travel there without a special permit. An ordinary salesman like Mr. Brox would never be granted a permit. Yesterday, Father put on another act. Groggy with sleep, he stumbled off to bed. His feet were cold, so I lent him my bed socks. 5 minutes later, he flung them to the floor. Then he pulled the blankets over his head because the light bothered him. The lamp was switched off, and he gingerly poked his head out from under the covers. It was all very amusing. We started talking about the fact that Peter says Margot is a Budinsky. Suddenly, Daddy's voice was heard from the depths. Sits on her butt, you mean? Mushi, the cat, is becoming nicer to me as time goes by, but I'm still somewhat afraid of her. Yours, Anne. Sunday, September 27th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, Mother and I had a so-called discussion today. But the annoying part is that I burst into tears. I can't help it. Daddy is always nice to me, and he also understands me much better. At moments like these, I can't stand Mother. It's obvious that I'm a stranger to her. She doesn't even know what I think about the most ordinary things. We were talking about maids and the fact that you're supposed to refer to them as domestic help these days. She claimed that when the war was over, that's what they'll want to be called. I didn't quite see it that way. Then she added that I talk about later so often that I act as if I were such a lady, even though I'm not. But I don't think building sandcastles in the air is such a terrible thing to do, as long as you don't take it too seriously. At any rate, Daddy usually comes to my defense. Without him, I wouldn't be able to stick it out here. I don't get along with Margot very well either. Even though our family never has the same kind of outbursts they have upstairs, I find it far from pleasant. Margot's and Mother's personalities are so alien to me. I understand my girlfriends better than my own mother. Isn't that a shame? For the umpteenth time, Mrs. Van Dan is sulking. She's very moody and has been removing more and more of her belongings and locking them up. It's too bad Mother doesn't repay every Van Dan disappearing act with a Frank disappearing act. Some people, like the Van Dans, seem to take special delight not only in raising their own children, but in helping others raise theirs. Margot doesn't need it, since she's naturally good, kind, and clever, perfection itself. But I seem to have enough mischief for the two of us. More than once, the air has been filled with the Van Dans' admonitions and my saucy replies. Father and Mother always defend me fiercely. Without them, I wouldn't be able to jump back into the fray with my usual composure. They keep telling me I should talk less, mind my own business, and be more modest, but I seem to be doomed to failure. If Father weren't so patient, I'd have long ago given up hope of ever meeting my parents' quite moderate expectations. If I take a small helping of vegetable I loathe and eat potatoes instead, the Van Dans, especially Mrs. Van Dan, can't get over how spoiled I am. "Come on, Anne, eat some more vegetables," she says. "No, thank you, ma'am," I reply. "The potatoes are more than enough." "Vegetables are good for you. Your mother says so too. Have some more, she insists, until Father intervenes and upholds my right to refuse a dish I don't like. Then Mrs. Van D really flies off the handle. You should have been at our house where children were brought up the way they should be. I don't call this a proper upbringing. Anne is terribly spoiled. I'd never allow that. If Anne were my daughter... This is always how her tirades begin and end. If Anne were my daughter. Thank goodness I'm not. But to get back to the subject of raising children. Yesterday a silence fell after Mrs. Van D finished her little speech. Father then replied, I think Anne is very well brought up. At least she's learned not to respond to your interminable sermons. As far as the vegetables are concerned, all I have to say is, look who's calling the kettle black. Mrs. Van D was soundly defeated. The pot calling the kettle black refers, of course, to Madame herself, since she can't tolerate beans or any kind of cabbage in the evening because they give her gas. But I could say the same. What a dope, don't you think? In any case, let's hope she stops talking about me. It's so funny to see how quickly Mrs. Van Dan flushes. I don't, and it secretly annoys her to no end. Yours, Anne. Monday, September 28th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, I had to stop yesterday, though I was nowhere near finished. I'm dying to tell you about another one of our clashes, but before I do, I'd like to say this. I think it's odd that grown-ups quarrel so easily and so often about such petty matters. Up to now, I always thought bickering was just something children did and that they outgrew it. Often, of course, there's sometimes a reason to have a real quarrel, but the verbal exchanges that take place here are just plain bickering. I should be used to the fact that these squabbles are daily occurrences, but I'm not and never will be as long as I'm the subject of nearly every discussion. They refer to these as discussions instead of quarrels, but Germans don't know the difference. They criticize everything, and I mean everything, about me. My behavior, my personality, my manners, every inch of me from head to toe and back again is the subject of gossip and debate. Harsh words and shouts are constantly being flung at my head, though I'm absolutely not used to it. According to the powers that be, I'm supposed to grin and bear it, but I can't. I have no intention of taking their insults lying down. I'll show them that Anne Frank wasn't born yesterday. They'll sit up and take notice and keep their big mouths shut when I make them see they ought to attend to their own manners instead of mine. How dare they act that way? It's simply barbaric. I've been astonished time and again at such rudeness and most of all at such stupidity, Mrs. Van Dan. But as soon as I've gotten used to the idea, and that shouldn't take long, I'll give them a taste of their own medicine, and then they'll change their tune. Am I really as bad-mannered, headstrong, stubborn, pushy, lazy, etc., etc., as the Van Dans say I am? No, of course not. I know I have my faults and shortcomings, but they blow them all out of proportion. If you only knew, Kitty, how I seethe when they scold and mock me. It won't take long before I explode with pent-up rage. But enough of that. I've bored you long enough with my quarrels, and yet I can't resist adding a highly interesting dinner conversation. Somehow we landed on the subject of Pim's extreme diffidence. His modesty is a well-known fact, which even the stupidest person wouldn't dream of questioning. All of a sudden, Mrs. Van Dan, who feels the need to bring herself into every conversation, remarked, I'm very modest and retiring, too, much more so than my husband. Have you ever heard anything so ridiculous? This sentence clearly illustrates that she's not exactly what you'd call modest. Mr. Van Dan, who felt obliged to explain the much more so than my husband, answered calmly, I have no desire to be modest in retiring. In my experience, you get a lot further by being pushy. And turning to me, he added, Don't be modest in retiring, Anne. It will get you nowhere. Mother agreed completely with his viewpoint. But as usual, Mrs. Van Dan had to add her 2 cents. This time, however, instead of addressing me directly, she turned to my parents and said, "You must have a strange outlook on life to be able to say that to Anne. Things were different when I was growing up, though they probably haven't changed much since then, except in your modern household." This was a direct hit at Mother's modern child-rearing methods, which she's defended on many occasions. Mrs. Van Dan was so upset her face turned bright red. People who flush easily become even more agitated when they feel themselves getting hot under the collar, and they quickly lose to their opponents. The non-flushed mother, who now wanted to have the matter over and done with as quickly as possible, paused for a moment to think before she replied, "Well, Mrs. Van Dan, I agree that it's much better if a person isn't over-modest. My husband, Margot, and Peter are all exceptionally modest. Your husband, Anne, and I, though not exactly the opposite, don't let ourselves be pushed around." Mrs. Van Dan, "Oh, but Mrs. Frank, I don't understand what you mean. Honestly, I'm extremely modest and retiring. How can you say that I'm pushy?" Mother, "I didn't say you're pushy, but no one would describe you as having a retiring disposition." Mrs. Van D, "I'd like to know in what way I'm pushy. If I didn't look out for myself here, no one else would, and I'd soon starve. But that doesn't mean I'm not as modest and retiring as your husband." Mother had no choice but to laugh at this ridiculous self-defense, which irritated Mrs. Van Dan. Not exactly a born debater, she continued her magnificent account in a mixture of German and Dutch until she got so tangled up in her own words that she finally rose from her chair and was just about to leave the room when her eye fell on me. You should have seen her. As luck would have it, the moment Mrs. Van D turned around, I was shaking my head in a combination of compassion and irony. I wasn't doing it on purpose, but I'd followed her tirade so intently that my reaction was completely involuntary. Mrs. Van D wheeled around and gave me a tongue-lashing, hard, Germanic, mean and vulgar, exactly like some fat, red-faced fishwife. It was a joy to behold. If I could draw, I'd like to have sketched her as she was then. She struck me as so comical, that silly little scatterbrain. I've learned one thing. You only really get to know a person after a fight. Only then can you judge their true character. Yours, Anne. Tuesday, September 29th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, the strangest things happen to you when you're in hiding. Try to picture this. Because we don't have a bathtub, we wash ourselves in a wash tub, and because there's only hot water in the office, by which I mean the entire lower floor, the seven of us take turns making the most of this great opportunity. But since none of us are alike and are all plagued by varying degrees of modesty, each member of the family has selected a different place to wash. Peter takes a bath in the office kitchen, even though it has a glass door. When it's time for his bath, he goes around to each of us in turn and announces that we shouldn't walk past the kitchen for the next half hour. He considers this measure to be sufficient. Mr. Van D takes his bath upstairs, figuring that the safety of his own room outweighs the difficulty of having to carry the hot water up all those stairs. Mrs. Van D has yet to take a bath. She's waiting to see which is the best place. Father bathes in the private office and Mother in the kitchen behind the fire screen, while Margot and I have declared the front office to be our bathing grounds. Since the curtains are drawn on Saturday afternoon, we scrub ourselves in the dark, while the one who isn't in the bath looks out the window through a chink in the curtains and gazes in wonder at the endlessly amusing people. A week ago, I decided I didn't like this spot and have been on the lookout for more comfortable bathing quarters. It was Peter who gave me the idea of setting my washtub in the spacious office bathroom. I can sit down, turn on the light, lock the door, pour out the water without anyone's help, and all without the fear of being seen. I used my lovely bathroom for the first time on Sunday, and strange as it may seem, I like it better than any other place. The plumber was at work downstairs on Wednesday, moving the water pipes and drains from the office bathroom to the hallway so the pipes won't freeze during a cold winter. The plumber's visit was far from pleasant. Not only were we not allowed to run water during the day, but the bathroom was also off limits. I'll tell you how we handled this problem. You may find it unseemly of me to bring it up, but I'm not so prudish about matters of this kind. On the day of our arrival, Father and I improvised a chamber pot, sacrificing a canning jar for this purpose. For the duration of the plumber's visit, canning jars were put into service during the daytime to hold our calls of nature. As far as I was concerned, this wasn't half as difficult as having to sit still all day and not say a word. You can imagine how hard that was for Miss Quack Quack Quack. On ordinary days, we have to speak in a whisper. Not being able to talk or move at all is 10 times worse. After 3 days of constant sitting, my backside was stiff and sore. Nightly calisthenics helped. Yours, Anne.
Coleman's Olive Oil, the book you might share, the book you need to get. Show через лес, повторим еще раз, вовек храни меня.
Thursday, October 1st, 1942. Dear Kitty, yesterday, I had a horrible fright. At 8 o'clock, the doorbell suddenly rang. All I could think of was that someone was coming to get us. You know who I mean. But I calmed down when everybody swore it must have been either pranksters or the mailman. The days here are very quiet. Mr. Levinson, a little Jewish pharmacist and chemist, is working for Mr. Kugler in the kitchen. Since he's familiar with the entire building, we're in constant dread that he'll take it into his head to go have a look at what used to be the laboratory. We're as still as baby mice. Who would have guessed 3 months ago that Quicksilver Anne would have to sit so quietly for hours on end, and what's more, that she could. Mrs. Van Dan's birthday was the 29th. Though we didn't have a large celebration, she was showered with flowers, simple gifts, and good food. Apparently, the red carnations from her spouse are a family tradition. Let me pause a moment on the subject of Mrs. Van Dan and tell you that her attempts to flirt with Father are a constant source of irritation to me. She pats him on the cheek and head, hikes up her skirt, and makes so-called witty remarks in an effort to get Pim's attention. Fortunately, he finds her neither pretty nor charming, so he doesn't respond to her flirtations. As you know, I'm quite the jealous type, and I can't abide her behavior. After all, Mother doesn't act that way towards Mr. Van D, which is what I told Mrs. Van D right to her face. From time to time, Peter can be very amusing. He and I have one thing in common. We like to dress up, which makes everyone laugh. One evening, we made our appearance, with Peter in one of his mother's skin-tight dresses and me in his suit. He wore a hat, I had a cap on. The grown-ups split their sides laughing, and we enjoyed ourselves every bit as much. Bet bought new skirts for Margot and me at the Bijenkorf. The fabric is hideous, like the burlap bag potatoes come in. Just the kind of thing the department stores wouldn't dare sell in the olden days, now costing 24 guilders for Margot's and 7.75 guilders for mine. We have a nice treat in store. Beps ordered a correspondence course in shorthand for Margot, Peter, and me. Just you wait. By this time next year, we'll be able to take perfect shorthand. In any case, learning to write a secret code like that is really interesting. I have a terrible pain in my index finger on my left hand, so I can't do any ironing. What luck! Mr. Van Dan wants me to sit next to him at the table, since Margot doesn't eat enough to suit him. Fine with me. I like changes. There's always a tiny black cat roaming around the yard, and it reminds me of my dear sweet Morcha. Another reason I welcome the change is that Mama's always carping at me, especially at the table. Now Margot will have to bear the brunt of it. Or rather, won't, since Mother doesn't make such sarcastic remarks to her. Not to that paragon of virtue. I'm always teasing Margot about being a paragon of virtue these days, and she hates it. Maybe it'll teach her not to be such a goody-goody. High time she learned. To end this hodgepodge of news, a particularly amusing joke told by Mr. Van Dan. What goes click 99 times and clack once? A centipede with a club foot. Bye-bye, Anne. Saturday, October 3rd, 1942. Dear Kitty, everybody teased me quite a bit yesterday because I lay down on the bed next to Mr. Van Dan. At your age! Shocking! And other remarks along those lines. Silly, of course. I'd never want to sleep with Mr. Van Dan the way they mean. Yesterday, Mother and I had another run-in, and she really kicked up a fuss. She told Daddy all my sins, and I started to cry, which made me cry too, and I already had such an awful headache. I finally told Daddy that I love him more than I do Mother, to which he replied that it was just a passing phase, but I don't think so. I simply can't stand Mother, and I have to force myself not to snap at her all the time and to stay calm when I'd rather slap her across the face. I don't know why I've taken such a terrible dislike to her. Daddy says that if Mother isn't feeling well or has a headache, I should volunteer to help her. But I'm not going to because I don't love her and I don't enjoy doing it. I can imagine Mother dying someday, but Daddy's death seems inconceivable. It's very mean of me, but that's how I feel. I hope Mother will never read this or anything else I've written. I've been allowed to read more grown-up books lately. Eva's Youth by Nico Van Suchtelen is currently keeping me busy. I don't think there's much of a difference between this and books for teenage girls. Eva thought that children grew on trees, like apples, and that the stork plucked them off the tree when they were ripe and brought them to their mothers. But her girlfriend's cat had kittens, and Eva saw them coming out of the cat, so she thought cats laid eggs and hatched them like chickens, and that mothers who wanted a child also went upstairs a few days before their time to lay an egg and brood on it. After the babies arrived, the mothers were pretty weak from all that squatting. At some point, Eva wanted a baby too. She took a wool scarf and spread it on the ground so the egg could fall into it, and then she squatted down and began to push. She clucked as she waited, but no egg came out. Finally, after she'd been sitting for a long time, something did come. But it was a sausage instead of an egg. Eva was embarrassed. She thought she was sick. Funny, isn't it? There are also parts of Eva's Youth that talk about women selling their bodies on the street and asking loads of money. I'd be mortified in front of a man like that. In addition, it mentions Eva's menstruation. Oh, I long to get my period. Then I'll really be grown up. Daddy is grumbling again and threatening to take away my diary. Oh, horror of horrors! From now on, I'm going to hide it. Anne Frank. Wednesday, October 7th, 1942. I imagine that I've gone to Switzerland. Daddy and I sleep in one room while the boys' study is turned into a sitting room where I can receive visitors. As a surprise, they've bought new furniture for me, including a tea table, a desk, armchairs, and a divan. Everything's simply wonderful. After a few days, Daddy gives me 150 guilders, converted into Swiss money, of course, but I'll call them guilders, and tells me to buy everything I think I'll need, all for myself. Later on, I get a guilder a week, which I can also use to buy whatever I want. I set off with Bernd and buy 3 cotton undershirts at 0.5 equals 1.5, 3 cotton underpants at 0.5 equals 1.5, 3 wool undershirts at 0.75 equals 2.25, 3 wool underpants at 0.75 equals 2.25, 2 petticoats at 0.5 equals 1, 2 bras, smallest size, at 0.5 equals 1, 5 pajamas at 1 equals 5, 1 summer robe at 2.5 equals 2.5, 1 winter robe at 3 equals 3, 2 bed jackets at 0.75 equals 1.5, 1 small pillow at 1 equals 1, 1 pair of lightweight slippers at 1 equals 1, 1 pair of warm slippers at 1.5 equals 1.5, 1 pair of summer shoes for school at 1.5 equals 1.5, 1 pair of summer shoes dressy at 2 equals 2, 1 pair of winter shoes for school at 2.5 equals 2.5, 1 pair of winter shoes dressy at 3 equals 3, 2 aprons at 0.5 equals 1, 25 handkerchiefs at 0.05 equals 1, 4 pairs of silk stockings at 0.75 equals 3, 4 pairs of knee socks at 0.5 equals 2, 4 pairs of socks at 0.25 equals 1, 2 pairs of thick stockings at 1 equals 2, 3 skeins of white yarn for an underwear and cap equals 1.5, 3 skeins of blue yarn, sweater and skirt equals 1.5, 3 skeins of variegated yarn, cap and scarf equals 1.5, scarves, belts, collars, buttons equals 1.25, plus 2 school dresses for summer, 2 school dresses for winter, 2 good dresses for summer, 2 good dresses for winter, 1 summer skirt, 1 good winter skirt, 1 school winter skirt, 1 raincoat, 1 summer coat, 1 winter coat, 2 hats, 2 caps, for a total of 100 guilders. 2 purses, 1 ice skating outfit, 1 pair of skates, 1 case containing powder, skin cream, foundation cream, cleansing cream, suntan lotion, cotton, first aid kit, rouge, lipstick, eyebrow pencil, bath salts, bath powder, eau de cologne, soap, powder puff, plus 4 sweaters at 150, 4 blouses at 1, miscellaneous items at 10, and books, presents at 4.5. October 9th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, today I have nothing but dismal and depressing news to report. Our many Jewish friends and acquaintances are being taken away in droves. The Gestapo is treating them very roughly and transporting them in cattle cars to Westerbork, the big camp in Drenthe, to which they're sending all the Jews. Miep told us about someone who'd managed to escape from there. It must be terrible in Westerbork. The people get almost nothing to eat, much less to drink, as water is available only 1 hour a day, and there's only one toilet and sink for several thousand people. Men and women sleep in the same room, and women and children often have their heads shaved. Escape is almost impossible. Many people look Jewish, and they're branded by their shorn heads. If it's that bad in Holland, what must it be like in those faraway and uncivilized places where the Germans are sending them? We assume that most of them are being murdered. The English radio says they're being gassed. Perhaps that's the quickest way to die. I feel terrible. Miep's accounts of these horrors are so heartrending, and Miep is also very distraught. The other day, for instance, the Gestapo deposited an elderly, crippled Jewish woman on Miep's doorstep while they set off to find a car. The old woman was terrified of the glaring searchlights and the guns firing at the English planes overhead. Yet Miep didn't dare let her in. Nobody would. The Germans are generous enough when it comes to punishment. Bep is also very subdued. Her boyfriend is being sent to Germany. Every time the planes fly over, she's afraid they're going to drop their entire bomb load on Bertus's head. Jokes like, "Oh, don't worry, they can't all fall on him," or "One bomb is all it takes," are hardly appropriate in this situation. Bertus is not the only one being forced to work in Germany. Trainloads of young men depart daily. Some of them try to sneak off the train when it stops at a small station, but only a few manage to escape unnoticed and find a place to hide. But that's not the end of my lamentations. Have you ever heard the term hostages? That's the latest punishment for saboteurs. It's the most horrible thing you can imagine. Leading citizens, innocent people, are taken prisoner to await their execution. If the Gestapo can't find the saboteur, they simply grab 5 hostages and line them up against the wall. You read the announcements of their death in the paper, where they're referred to as fatal accidents. Fine specimens of humanity, those Germans. And to think I'm actually one of them. No, that's not true. Hitler took away our nationality long ago. And besides, there are no greater enemies on earth than the Germans and the Jews. Yours, Anne.
That's all the time we have for today's readings from Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl. Join us at the same time next week. Thanks again for listening. If you know someone who could benefit from our service, point them our direction. If you know someone who would like to contribute in any way, point them in our direction. You can call us at 919-832-5138 or visit our website at trianglereadingservice.org. Once again, I'm Randy Wasserstrom. From Susie, from me, and everyone here at TRRS, have a nice rest of the day.